has to be continued within the United States. The Voting Rights Act of 1965, therefore, is one of the most important tools for that. It broke open, especially in the South, but also in places like New Mexico and California, it broke open the possibilities of people with a different language and of black people especially being allowed to vote, being able to vote without all the hatred and rage against their voting and their right
Reverend
to vote.
Reverend Lawson, we're going to continue the discussion on the Voting Rights Act after the show and post it at democracynow.org. I want to thank Reverend James Lawson and Reverend John Deere. That does it for our show. I'll be speaking tonight in Manhasset on the 70th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 4:59. Stay tuned for the Thursday KBOO Evening News.
Tune in to the podcast Probable Cause This on the KBOO website, kboo.fm/probablecause. On this podcast, I look at the top stories on the lack of accountability for police and public officials in Oregon and across the country. That's kboo.fm/probablecause for a weekly roundup of stories on holding our public officials accountable to we the people.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Montevilla Jazz Festival, Saturday, August 15th and Sunday, August 16th at Portland Metro Arts. The Montevilla Jazz Festival showcases the best of Portland-based artists, including the Alan Jones Sextet, the Ed Bennett Quintet, Machete Order, and Portland Jazz Composers Ensemble, and many more. Again, that's the Montevilla Jazz Festival, Saturday, August 15th, and Sunday, August 16th at Portland Metro Arts, 9003 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, today marks both the 70th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and the 50th anniversary of the signing into law of the Voting Rights Act.
The autopsy of 19-year-old Zachary Hammond, killed by police on July 30th in South Carolina, shows that the bullets entered through his back, challenging the official police account of his death.
And we'll take an in-depth look at people who live in boats on the Willamette River and the legal troubles many of them face.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 6th, 2015. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Doug McVeigh. 70 years ago today, the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on the city of Hiroshima, Japan. Activists and community members are gathering in Portland this evening to hold a memorial event marking the anniversary. I spoke with Kelly Campbell, Executive Director of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, to find out more.
So today is the 70th anniversary of the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima, the first use of an atomic weapon against another country. And here in Portland, we'll be commemorating that event, mourning the lives lost and working toward a nuclear-free future with an event at the Japanese American Plaza tonight at 6 p.m. It's down on Portland's Waterfront Park at Northwest NATO and Cooch Street. And the event will go from 6 until about 7:30. We'll have a speakers, including Michiko Kornhauser, who is a survivor of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, Joe Inlet from the Marshall Islands, talking about the issues of the use of the Marshall Islands for nuclear testing grounds, and Carol Erner with Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, who is one of the organizers of the first time this event was done in Portland back in 1962. Carol will be discussing what we can do to create a nuclear-free future and the various policy initiatives that are in play right now. We'll also have performances by Portland Taiko and the Sahomi Tachibana traditional Japanese dancers, and opportunities for people to learn how to fold origami cranes, sign petitions, and get involved with the nuclear movement.
For those folks who can't make it, how can they find out more about the event and about your organization?
You can visit our website at www.oregonpsr.org, and you can find more information there about working for a nuclear-free future.
Kelly, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
That memorial event, once again, begins at 6 p.m. this evening at the Japanese American Historical Plaza in Waterfront Park at Northwest NATO Parkway and Cooch Street.
This coming Sunday, the 9th of August, marks the one-year anniversary of the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Brown, an unarmed black teenager, was fatally shot by Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson after allegedly stealing cigarillos from a nearby convenience store. Brown's death ignited unrest in Ferguson and protests across the country, including in Portland.
Make it clear that police brutality is something that needs to be taken seriously. That something shouldn't be. It shouldn't be something that people just say, "Oh, okay, this guy's going to be suspended with pay." It needs to be disciplined. It needs to be removed from the entire system, or it's going to cause serious problems.
This weekend, to commemorate the killing of Brown and other black men and women by white police officers, a coalition of groups including Don't Shoot PDX, 15 Now, and others is holding a three-day series of events. We spoke to Teresa Rayford, an organizer with Don't Shoot PDX, for more details.
What has Don't Shoot Portland's interactions been like with the Portland Police Bureau and the Police Association in particular?
Well, as far as the Bureau, our interaction was initially being done with the police commissioner, who's Charlie Hill, but then the talks weren't going that good because of the inconsistency as far as the agreement on our meetings, our times, our community engagement, and even the terms of why we wanted to meet. When all of those things changed, we were unable to continue that path because we knew that with legislative session coming up, we needed to look out for all Oregonians through the state legislator and make sure that whatever policy we needed enhanced to provide public safety for, you know, citizens of color against police brutality was going to have to come from a state level. So special prosecutor bills and things like that are some of the actions that we had to take with senators like Chip Shields and people like Jennifer Williamson that were leading that legal platform in Salem. We just wanted to make sure that our voices were on the record as they came. And so we just used political action. And we had a great season. The session, it ended pretty good. But I think a lot of the legislation was watered down. And so we're excited to be connecting with Portland Rising Tide to basically become a part of an organization called Flood the System, where now we're going to have even more enhanced political power because of alliances with other activist organizations, and using that political power to influence our policymakers to do the right thing, and at the same time empowering activists through nonviolent direct action.
The activism end of things is a pretty significant component of what's going to be happening this weekend. Can you tell our listeners tomorrow in particular what's going to be going on and where?
Absolutely. Well, tomorrow at First Unitarian Church, starting at 3:30 with the network meet and greet, we're going to have community action panels focused on political action, black youth, And then I think it's access to justice. And what these panels consist of is an intergenerational leadership that's been in the Black community here in Portland for, you know, since before I was born. We have people like Cal Henry, the president of the Oregon Assembly for Black Affairs. We have leadership that's 16 years old, Maikia Hernandez, who has, you know, several scholarships around the country. She's a young Black student from MLC. We have people like Noni Kazi and Carl Talton and just amazing people. Marcus Cooper and Glenn Waco will be on panels. We have educators like Chris Reiser and Brian Chu and Tamberly Tarver. Just it's so much stuff. We're going to be talking about school-to-prison pipeline and just all the issues that are dominating our community.
On Sunday, the 9th, how are you commemorating the killing of Michael Brown?
So after we basically educate people on why we organize during the panels, on Sunday we'll be doing a community art project. And the community art project, we're hoping that we can get a ton of donations and have a lot of community come out and basically create their own images of life and love and community and happiness and just use those pictures and those visuals to basically honor Mike Brown and all our victims of police violence across the country and the nation. Because we can't have a holiday or an event every time we want to celebrate someone's name that we've carried. So let's just do everything from a point that's going to continue. And so we're going to have everybody come out on Sunday. We'll be making signs, hot dogs, hamburgers. Glenn Waco will be out there presenting different artists from the community. We're going to have a nonviolent direct action training from Portland Rising Tide and some of the Shell No activists. 15 now will be out there. All of our different community grassroots organizations will be out there together. So I'm just excited. And afterwards, we'll go to see Senator, what are we calling U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders and see what his agenda is, because I believe that all the items that he listed are Black Lives Matter issues. And so since he is going to be out here for, you know, the anniversary of Mike Brown's death, I think it would be very significant for him to address us and contact us and just allow us in that space to hear him. And I hope he addresses it.
All right. Teresa Rayford, lifelong Oregonian and organizer with Don't Shoot Portland, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Sam. You have a good day, man.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Sam Bowman speaking with Teresa Rayford of Don't Shoot Portland.
Clatskanie, Oregon Police Chief Marvin Hoover has been placed on paid administrative leave while the department investigates allegations that the chief recently made some racist comments. The Clatskanie Police Department and the city have not disclosed the nature of the comments, nor when and where they were made, because the investigation is ongoing. Hoover joined the Clatskanie Department in 1999 and has been chief since 2002. The probe is expected to last 2 weeks. The department has not yet named an interim chief.
19-year-old Zachary Hammond was shot and killed by police in a Hardee's parking lot in Seneca, South Carolina, on July 30th. Police at the time claimed that Hammond, who was unarmed, had been driving his vehicle toward the officer who fired the fatal shots. Yesterday, Hammond's family released the results of a private autopsy, which found that the bullets entered his body from the back. The official autopsy report only noted the two bullet wounds and did not say from what direction they had been fired. Hammond had been on a first date with Tori Morton, who local police had suspected was a small-time pot dealer. Seneca police had set up a drug bust in the parking lot to catch Morton, who was arrested and charged with possession of just 10 grams of marijuana. The officer who shot and killed Hammond, whose name has not yet been released, is on administrative leave pending an investigation.
Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum yesterday announced that the State Justice Department had reached a $1.1 million settlement with the pharmaceutical manufacturer Insys. The settlement resolves allegations that the company was improperly marketing its drug Subsys, a fentanyl-based painkiller. Fentanyl is an extremely powerful opiate, which, according to the Centers for Disease Control, is hundreds of times more powerful than pharmaceutically pure heroin. The Oregon Justice Department alleged that Insys had provided, quote, improper financial incentives to some doctors to increase Subsys prescriptions, and had targeted doctors for aggressive promotion of Subsys even when the doctors were not qualified to prescribe it. and had deceptively promoted their drug for treatment of mild pain. Subsys is approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration for treatment of breakthrough cancer pain, and according to the FDA, it is only for use by cancer patients who have been taking other opiates and whose bodies have developed a tolerance to opiates. The FDA specifically says it is not for treating short-term pain. The feds have also been looking at incest, and in June, a Connecticut nurse pled guilty to federal charges of accepting more than $80,000 in kickbacks from the company for promoting the drug.
On Tuesday, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, released a draft environmental review of the proposed Warrenton LNG terminal. The LNG stands for liquefied natural gas, or natural gas that has been supercooled to a liquid state for easier transportation through pipelines. Two LNG export terminals are currently seeking permits at the state and federal level in Oregon, the Warrenton facility and another at Jordan Cove near Coos Bay. The proposals have been met with fierce resistance from environmental groups, local governments, and landowners whose property could be seized using eminent domain to make way for pipelines connecting the terminals to existing natural gas infrastructure. The Jordan Cove pipeline would stretch all the way to Malin near Klamath Falls, and the Warrenton pipeline would cross heavily forested areas in Clatsop and Columbia counties. KABU spoke with Dan Sears, the conservation director with Columbia Riverkeeper, about FERC's role in LNG export projects in Oregon. The Federal Environmental Regulatory Commission released their draft environmental review for the Oregon LNG Warrenton terminal on the 4th. Can you tell us the significance of this?
It's been a busy week for the Oregon LNG project, and not surprisingly, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has released its version of a draft environmental impact statement for Oregon LNG. FERC has a history of glossing over the negative impacts of these projects, and so we've never hung our hat on a firm, thorough analysis from FERC. Rather, we're counting on the state of Oregon to protect Oregonians, to stand up and reject Oregon LNG, where FERC is clearly in a posture to rubber stamp the project.
The Clatsop County Board denied a permit to Oregon LNG to continue with this project. What's the significance of that rejection in light of the fact that Oregon LNG is continuing to pursue this project?
It's very significant. Clatsop County was effectively applying Oregon's Coastal Zone Management Act, and as a result, their rejection should cause the state of Oregon to also deny the Oregon LNG project. Oregon LNG is facing roadblocks at every turn. FERC is really the only agency that's indicating they plan to give them a thumbs up. Even the Army Corps of Engineers has recently decided that they have an easement to dispose of dredge spoils on the same property where Oregon LNG would be. So whether it's the Clatsop County decision, which we believe is valid and should be upheld, or the Army Corps of Engineers, there is, you know, one roadblock after another that Oregon LNG is facing. And we think this project needs to come to an end so that we can focus on the Jordan Cove LNG terminal and the threat that that poses to people in Coos Bay.
Speaking of Jordan, Jordan Cove, has FERC already given them a draft environmental review? Are they way further along than Oregon LNG is right now?
Yes, FERC has issued a draft environmental impact statement, and we expect the final environmental impact statement for the Coos Bay Jordan Cove LNG terminal in late September. That's a very important time, and right now is critical to have people weigh in with Governor Brown and with Oregon state agencies, because they can be in the position of actually challenging that FERC rubber stamp of both of these LNG projects. But Jordan Cove will come first, and it sets a very important precedent for the entire state that we are going to say no to LNG in Oregon.
What are the necessary state agencies, and where do they seem to be standing on this right now?
It's sort of an alphabet soup of agencies, and that's what's important to realize, is that the state of Oregon has all the authority it needs to say no to this. For Oregon LNG on the Columbia River, the Department of Land Conservation and Development could deny that project tomorrow, and they should. It's long overdue. The citizens of Clatsop County have spoken, and it's time for the state to truncate that project. For the Jordan Cove LNG terminal, the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality has a very important analysis to do under the Clean Water Act. Jordan Cove would cross over 400 streams and rivers and wetlands with a huge 36-inch high-pressure, non-odorized pipeline, doing an enormous amount of damage to watersheds all over southern Oregon. The state of Oregon can simply find that that's not the type of project that meets our clean water laws. And so we'll be calling on the state of Oregon to deny the Jordan Cove LNG terminal the same way it denied the Bradwood LNG terminal on the Columbia River many years ago. There's a precedent here that the state of Oregon has the authority it needs to say no. And so those are two very important agencies that have the authority and the power. But the power rests with the people of Oregon to demand that our state leaders and our elected officials and our regulatory agencies do the right thing and do it quickly.
Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Sam.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Sam Bowman, speaking with Dan Sears, the Conservation Director with Columbia Riverkeeper.
Today is the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, one of the most significant laws to come out of the civil rights movement. Despite the fact that the law has been eroded in past years, the act continues to diminish the effect of discrimination in the voting system. Yesterday, the Texas voter ID law was struck down because it violated the Voting Rights Act. The law had required voters to have specific and government-issued identification before voting. The district judge cited the Voting Rights Act and ruled the law disproportionately affected poor people and racial minorities, putting an unconstitutional burden on voting. KBOO reporter Catherine Matichek spoke with Stephen Spaulding from Common Cause about the history of the act and its future in our democratic system.
I'm speaking with Stephen Spaulding, Policy Counsel with Common Cause. Thank you for speaking with me today, Stephen.
Thanks for having me.
So today is the 50th anniversary of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. 50 years later, do you believe that the law has achieved what it is designed to do?
Well, the Voting Rights Act was is the most successful piece of civil rights legislation to come out of the 20th century. It brought scores of voters into the process and was an absolute bulwark and continues to be against discriminatory voting practices. That said, it was incredibly successful and was continuing to be successful when the Supreme Court struck down a core provision of the act back in 2013 in the Shelby County case. But the act had been reauthorized by Congress in a bipartisan fashion many, many times. As most recently in 2006, the Congress voted overwhelmingly, unanimously in the Senate, 330 votes in the House to say, yeah, discrimination in voting is still a problem in this country and we need to stick with the Voting Rights Act to prevent it.
Do you think that ruling had anything to do with all the voter ID laws, specifically the Texas voter ID law, that have come in recent years that are very discriminatory?
Absolutely. So literally, I mean, Texas is one example. North Carolina is another. No sooner did the ink dry in the Supreme Court's decision in Shelby County did legislators in North Carolina pass a massive bill that makes it harder to vote and disproportionately so for voters of color. Those laws were passed almost immediately after Shelby County, and had the Voting Rights Act still been on the books at full strength, we don't think those laws would have seen the light of day.
Access to voting is obviously foundational to any democracy. What do you think it says about the current state of our political system that certain people are continually excluded from this process?
There are politicians that are trying to rig the rules, and there are still parts of the Voting Rights Act on the books. Just yesterday, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down Texas's voter ID law and said it violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. So it still found that the law was discriminatory. Had the law been on the books at full strength, that voter ID law would have been blocked years ago, but instead parties had to go through the time and expense of litigation. But no doubt, you know, a democracy is based on everyone having an equal say, and it's totally un-American and anathema to democracy to enact rules that make it harder for some people to vote. It's just shocking that this is still happening in the year 2015, and it's something that, you know, our country continues to wrestle with. There is a bill in Congress to bring the Voting Rights Act back to full strength, and we urge the Republican leadership to at least grant it a hearing and get that process moving.
Do you think that there's a connection with trying to exclude certain populations from voting as well as the continued influence of big money in politics?
Yeah, I mean, no doubt. I think, you know, we've been using a mantra that we want to get money out and voters in. I think voting rights and money in politics are two sides of the same coin. They both both our voting laws and our campaign finance laws can either create pathways to bring people in or can put up walls to keep people out. Very closely connected strains here in our democracy that we are dealing with in the face of a relatively hostile Supreme Court.
Looking back 50 years, the Voting Rights Act has made a lot of progress, but like you said, we have a long way to go. What is the hope moving forward?
Well, the hope moving forward is there are efforts at the state level, and of course, Oregon is leading the way with automatic voter registration. That is bringing people into the process. We know what we need to do. We need to expand early voting. We need to modernize voter registration. We need to right the balance so that, again, everyone has an equal right to be heard. We need to revitalize and restore the strength of the Voting Rights Act because, again, it has been so important to guard against discrimination in voting.
I've been speaking with Stephen Spaulding, Policy Counsel with Common Cause. This is Catherine Maticek with KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth, where we'll take a look at the legal troubles faced by people who live on boats in the Willamette River. This will be followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland, focusing on the possible effects of the Trans-Pacific Partnership on Black America. Tomorrow's weather will be clear and warm, with a high of 86 and a low of 59. In history, today marks the independence of both Bolivia in 1825 and Jamaica in 1962. In 1945, the United States Army Air Force dropped the first atomic bomb used in warfare on the Japanese city of Hiroshima, killing at least 90,000 people, most of them civilians, and ushering in the atomic age. The quote of the day is from German author Günter Grass. How do we prevent Iran from developing an atomic bomb when, on the American side, dropping an atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki is not considered a war crime?
It's 5:26, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Big story from that razzle-dazzle place called El Casino Grande, otherwise known as Wall Street. Four massive financial conglomerates, JP Morgan Chase, Citigroup, Barclays, and the Royal Bank of Scotland, have been caught in a criminal conspiracy to rig the global currency market. Bank regulators have now slapped them with an equally massive fine, totaling $5.4 billion. The financial felons coordinated their illegal currency manipulation scheme through online chat rooms with devil-may-care names like the Cartel and the Mafia. The bank's culture of greed led to such a reckless arrogance that one of Barclays' price fixers offered this bit of ethical encouragement to his chat room pals. If you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. Well, taking a $5 billion hit will put an end to that sort of reprobate banksterism, won't it? No. While this was the first time that banks themselves had to admit that they are corporate criminals, all of them are free to continue doing currency trading, and no top executives were even charged for the crimes they oversaw. And while $5 billion is a huge record-level criminal penalty, it's easily absorbed by these global casino operations. In the first 3 months of this year, for example, J.P. Morgan Chase raked in $4 billion just from its fixed income and currency trading division, about seven times its share of the penalty levied against the four corporate crooks. This is Jim Hightower saying Citigroup CEO called the punishment, quote, an embarrassment to his bank. But banks can't feel embarrassed, nor can they commit crimes. Only bankers can. And, as should be obvious by now, being embarrassed is no deterrent at all to their endlessly creative criminality. If we actually want to stop their crimes, the bankster themselves must feel the punishment.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out at hightowerlowdown.org.
A federal appeals court has upheld a lower court's decision to award Chevron a sum of $96 million in the latest development in an ongoing legal battle with both the people and the government of Ecuador. KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke with Paul Pazamino of Amazon Watch about the history of the litigation. He explained how this ruling doesn't exactly spell a victory for the oil and gas giant.
What happened was that Texaco, now Chevron, was the first company to drill for oil in the Amazon back in the 1960s. They drilled for decades, and they designed a system to intentionally pollute, dumping 18 billion gallons of toxic waste into the pristine Ecuadorian Amazon rainforest while they extracted crude oil. They basically left close to 1,000 unlined open-air waste pits where they dumped toxic foundation waters, which are the byproduct of drilling for crude oil. Then in 1992, their consortium ended and they left Ecuador and immediately were sued in a civil case in New York by the communities who had been affected by the decades of pollution. At that time, Ecuador's government oil company, PetroEcuador, took over operation of the oil fields and over time improved and changed the system so that it would re-inject the toxic foundation waters that had polluted the Amazon. So Chevron deliberately created what many people call an Amazon Chernobyl, causing thousands of deaths from cancer, wiping out entire indigenous communities, and the medical estimates are that up to 10,000 people will eventually contract cancer from the toxins that have been left in the environment. Then, after many years of suing in New York, Chevron, at that point, had taken over Texaco, won a verdict in their favor, and the trial was moved from New York down to Ecuador, and the Ecuadorians sued again there. And another 10 years of waiting for justice, they achieved a verdict in 2011 in their favor, saying that Chevron should pay $9.5 billion to remediate and provide health support for the communities in Ecuador. Chevron had since pulled all of his assets out of Ecuador and refused to pay, instead turned around and accused Ecuadorians and their lawyers of perpetrating a fraud against them and being part of an international conspiracy to try to extort money from them, and have refused to pay. So this company has spared no expense, hired 60 law firms, spent an estimated $2 billion just to fight against cleaning up what it deliberately did in the 60s. And by the way, I should say, they admitted to deliberately dumping that waste in the first place. So this is probably one of the most important, most horrific cases of corporate misdeed and corporate accountability that we've seen to date. And unfortunately, because Chevron has never-ending pockets, they've continued to fight year after year after year to try to prevent justice.
At some point, the arbitration process became involved in this matter and reduced whatever judgment in any court was going to be bestowed back to the Ecuadorians. And they're still fighting even, I believe it was like 1/10 of what they originally were said to owe.
Chevron has tried everything it could to avoid paying. And one of the things that they've employed is a strategy of forum shopping. While they were suing the Ecuadorians in New York federal court, the same court that they argued shouldn't hear the first case, they also pursued actions in The Hague under a bilateral trade agreement. One of those was suing the government of Ecuador, saying that it owed $96 million for breach of the contract that they had when they were part of a consortium and operating the oil fields in the 60s to the 90s. There was a decision made to award Chevron $96 million, which has been recently upheld. With interest, it's now $106 million. And the irony is that it's seen by some as a victory for Chevron, but in fact, it's the opposite. Because Chevron owes $9.5 billion to the people of Ecuador, whom it deliberately poisoned. Any assets in Ecuador that would be Chevron's would be immediately turned over to those people because there's a valid judgment against Chevron. So should the government of Ecuador pay the $106 million that's owed, it would immediately go into an escrow account and be turned over to the communities who are owed at this point $9.5 billion. If anything, this will turn around and help the Ecuadorian communities and hurt Chevron.
I've been talking with Paul Pazamino. He's the Outreach and Online Strategy Director at Amazon Watch. For more information, you can visit their website at amazonwatch.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
The National Conference of State Legislators, or NCSL, is holding its annual meeting in Seattle, Washington this week. Earlier today, the group approved a resolution calling for changes in federal law to allow individual states to legalize, tax, and regulate marijuana. KBOO spoke with Mason Tvert, Director of Communications for the Marijuana Policy Project, to find out more.
Sure. Well, the resolution that was adopted simply says that the federal government should refrain from interfering in states that have adopted their own marijuana policies, states like Oregon and Colorado and Washington, as well as states with medical marijuana laws. It also asks for federal laws to be changed to very explicitly say that states have the ability to create their own marijuana policies. So this is a clear message to Congress and to the administration.
Now, there have been riders attached to appropriations bills telling the federal government that they should not interfere with state implementation of state laws. How does what the NCSL is asking for differ from that?
Well, really, legislators want clarity and they want it to be concrete. It's one thing for the federal government to have a policy of not interfering and to pass these amendments on appropriations bills that, you know, say the federal government will not spend money on interfering, but they want it to be very clear that the federal government cannot interfere and that states have this ability, because when it comes to legislators in these states, they do not want to be conflicting with federal law. They just want it to be very clear.
Now, is this the most success that you and other reformers have had at the NCSL?
From what I understand, this is really the first very big development. It's certainly the biggest that I've heard of. We've also seen groups like the National Conference of Mayors speak out in support of decriminalizing possession of small amounts of marijuana. So we've seen these types of you know, government associations taking these actions, but this is a very strong and very clear message that was sent by an organization that represents all of our state legislatures.
A lot of the progress in reforming marijuana laws in the last few years has been at the ballot box with state initiatives. Do you and MPP see potential for more of the state legislatures themselves to get involved?
Absolutely. We're seeing a lot of movement in state legislatures. A lot of the latest medical marijuana laws that have passed and decriminalization laws have all been through legislatures. This year, Delaware and Illinois both passed decriminalization measures of small amounts of marijuana through their legislatures. And we really hope to see broader measures similar to the laws passed in Oregon and Colorado that make marijuana legal for adults. We want to see those pass through the legislatures in Rhode Island and Vermont next year. And there's a host of other states where we expect to see similar laws pass over the next few years.
Now, shifting from the state just for a moment to the national, as long as I have you on the line, what do we have happening in Congress now, and do you see chance for some good legislation to pass in this session?
Well, Congress is constantly considering marijuana-related legislation, and there are some bills out there that are very good, and it's really, I would say, in large part, more of a question of Congress overall than just Congress on marijuana. Right now, we have a situation where they're not getting a lot done on any issue. And so it's not really unique to marijuana policy. We've seen some measures passing with regard to appropriations amendments, which you mentioned earlier, measures that prohibit the Justice Department from using federal funds to interfere in state marijuana laws, that type of thing. But there's also some more comprehensive legislation like the CARERS Act, which is being considered in the U.S. Senate, and we hope to see that move forward once the Senate comes back from their recess, and they've been picking up sponsors, and I think there's now 15 co-sponsors in the Senate, which is really pretty impressive.
Mason Tvert, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Mason Tvert. He's the Director of Communications at the Marijuana Policy Project. This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. UAW Local 2865, representing 13,000 UC grad student workers, is calling for the ouster of the International Union of Police Associations from the AFL-CIO. UAW Local 2865's Brandon Buchanan says that the IUPA is inimical to the interests of labor.
And in particular, contrary to the interests of black workers, our letter calls for the AFL CIO to disaffiliate from this union in an effort to pursue its stated goals of fighting oppression and privation. And we argue that police support and actually require that oppression to do the kind of work that they are expected to do. Police cannot be a part of the labor movement because they stand against the interests of workers and against the interests of black communities in particular.
Dennis Slocum is legislative director for the International Union of Police Associations.
It's impossible to stand for the rights of working class people while opposing the people in law enforcement. We are working class, and we think this is nothing but a publicity stunt for a group that's struggling for some sort of attention. They don't call for their own union to disgorge police officers. They haven't called on AFSCME or CWA or any of the other organizations that represent police officers within the AFL-CIO. The Teamsters and SEIU, who are outside of the AFL-CIO, but certainly our labor organizations, also represent police officers.
UAW Local 2865 maintains that police unions serve the interests of police as an arm of the state and not the interests of police as laborers. Slocum says police unions represent their members in due process proceedings and enforce democratically enacted laws, but it does not condone illegal actions by police officers. The International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers is welcoming nearly 1,000 new members at the Letterkenny Army Depot in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. The workers employed by Bowhead Support Group, LLC, voted to join the IAM after a year-long organizing effort. The workers joined the IAM over issues like stagnant wages, increasing health care costs, and inadequate benefits. Responding to the new Obama administration power plant emissions regulations proposal, the United Steelworkers says it's committed to helping design state implementation plans that balance the need to address climate change with the need to ensure that U.S. workers and industries are not unfairly hurt in the process. The USW says it was one of the first industrial unions to endorse a comprehensive climate change bill. The steelworkers say that it's essential that the final rule achieves its intended goal of reducing our nation's emissions of carbon dioxide and capitalizes on the broader potential of maintaining and creating jobs across our nation in the energy and manufacturing industries. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Catherine Maticek, Doug McVeigh, Robin Ryan, and Kristen Yount. The producer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to Henry Leisha. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Doug McVeigh.
And I'm Sam Bowman. Coming up Friday morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Ani and Lynn host Positively Revolting Talk Radio, a variety of topics from an eco-feminist and anarcho-feminist perspective. At 9, on Political Perspectives, host Doug McVeigh speaks with Inga Frickland, board member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, or LEAP, about LEAP, the development of the war on drugs, and the movement for the legalization of drugs. At 10, Air Cascadia is off. We'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Sarika Mehta hosts Intersections Radio, aiming to connect communities through unique and unexpected stories. And at 11:30 on the Radio Zine, we speak with members of the Chilean reggae band Aflora Reggae about the state of the educational system in Chile, the impact of the neoliberal economy, and the exploitation of natural resources, and the intention of their music to promote unity in the world. Thanks for listening to KBOO, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And stay tuned now for an in-depth look at live aboard boaters on the Willamette River with KBOO reporter Henry Leisha. Good night, Sam.
Good night, Doug.
Good night, Sequana.
Good night.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Along the lower Willamette,